Hello, Florida Bar members and Florida registered paralegals. This is a quick reminder from the Standing Committee on Mental Health and Wellness of Florida Lawyers that you are approved to use the Florida Lawyers Helpline, a completely free and confidential around-the-clock helpline designed to support you in managing the challenges of both your personal and professional life. By dialing 833-FL1-WELL or 833-351-9355, you can connect with mental health professionals who are ready to assist you. Take advantage of up to 5 complimentary in-person or telehealth counseling sessions annually, and remember, there's no limit to the number of calls you can make. Reach out today.
You're listening to the Florida Bar Podcast, brought to you by the Florida Bar's Practice Resource Center, Legal Fuel. Produced by the broadcast professionals of the Florida Bar.
Welcome to the Florida Bar's Legal Fuel Podcast, brought to you by the Practice Resource Center of the Florida Bar. We're so glad you're joining us. This is Christine Bilberry. I'm the director of the Practice Resource Center and one of the hosts of the show, which is being recorded from our studio in Tallahassee, Florida.
And I'm Autumn Chadwell. I'm a practice management advisor at the Florida Bar and co-host of today's podcast. Our goal at the Practice Resource Center is to assist Florida attorneys with running the business side of their law practices. You can find all of our resources and free CLEs at legalfuel.com.
So in Rule 4-1.1 of the rules regulating the Florida Bar under the section on competence, it says that a lawyer should keep abreast of changes in the law and its practice, including an understanding of the benefits and risks associated with the use of technology. Technology is constantly changing, and while new technologies can be exciting and make your life easier, cyber hacking technology is becoming ever more sophisticated. So today we are speaking with Kehinde Stinson about what you can do to safeguard your practice, your client data, and how to establish best practices for your firm.
Kehinde Stinson is a technology and data governance attorney with more than 15 years of legal experience focused on privacy, cybersecurity, and emerging technology governance. She advises organizations on data governance, privacy compliance, and cybersecurity risk management in increasingly complex digital environments and provides consulting services through her firm, TechMeOut LLC. Kehinde also hosts a podcast exploring the societal and legal implications of data and artificial intelligence and frequently speaks on privacy, cybersecurity, and technology governance. Welcome to the show, Kehinde.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me, Christine. How are you doing today?
We are doing very well, and we're excited to have you because we got to see you down in Orlando at the Florida Bar's annual convention where you presented at our technology symposium, and you did such a great job. We were excited to have you come on the podcast. So let's start by talking about what makes law firms both so valuable as well as so susceptible to cybersecurity threats.
Great. So mid to small law firms have a tremendous amount of communication and collaboration with data. So just generally speaking, lawyers have a strong relationship with the clients that they retain long term. And as that relationship grows, we tend to gain information from them. So besides the actual case or matter that we are retained for, we also gain insight into confidential information, financial data, other sensitive issues related to how they do business, their careers, and even intellectual property is sometimes disclosed to counsel. And so that's just a part of the relationship. And this in turn makes us so incredibly susceptible and interesting to your typical cybersecurity hacker, because all of that data is valuable, even to your competitors. You have nation states siphoning or trying to get access to your larger K Street law firm's data subsets and repositories because that data would be valuable if it got into the wrong hands. And so when you take a look at the relationship that law firms have with their clients as they evolve, more and more confidential, sensitive business information is going to be disclosed and transferred throughout that relationship. And so that's why it's so important that there's cogent, strong, and robust cybersecurity practices at law firms.
And I think a lot of solo and small firms think, oh, well, they're not going to try to hack me. But someone who has a tiny practice, maybe they do family law. And when you consider all the financial disclosures that are required by Florida state law, that is a ton of data sitting there. Their social security numbers, their income, you know, their bank accounts, their investments. You don't have to be too small to be an attractive target.
Absolutely not. The goal is to get any leverage that you can. As a hacker, as a cybersecurity attacker, this is a very lucrative business for them. And so it doesn't matter. They're playing the long game, and it's about quality versus quantity. What typically happens is that hackers will infiltrate a system and sit and actually pore over that information to see what's most valuable. And as we know, that value is in flux constantly. So something could be happening 3-4 years from now with that data that's sitting in your system, and they're not going to attack that. They're just going to hold it and wait until that value manifests itself. But I mean, I'm hearing it over and over again. Data is king. Data is valuable. It doesn't matter who we can get it from a hacker's perspective. I'm going to try to get as much as possible.
Can you talk to us about what the most common ways that law firms are currently being compromised are?
So the number one, and I spent a significant amount of time at the symposium discussing that, is through when someone takes a look at someone's email, infiltrates their system, and pretends as if they are that person. They're not really that individual. They've been able to attack and infiltrate the system as if they were that individual. And so they infiltrate that person's operational systems by pretending as if they are that person. So once they get access to that individual through a phishing attack, for example, and that's the primary example, is that you will receive an email that does three things. The first thing it does, it comes from someone that you're used to communicating with. And so that level of having a preventive posture is eliminated by just seeing that familiar addressee. Second, there's an emotional trigger usually associated with a phishing attack. So it's going to say there's a timeline, there's urgency. You have 48 hours, or I tried to reach you last night. That's why I'm sending this to you at 2 a.m. Could you please send me the bank account numbers as quickly as possible? And then there's a connection to your livelihood usually. So it's going to be a work email. It's going to be a project that you might not be super familiar with. It's going to be mentioned. And when those three things happen, when you have this familiarity in the person who sent it to you, there's a time sensitive nature associated with your response, and that you're asked to do something that affects your livelihood or your child or your grandparent or something like that. That's more than likely going to be a phishing attack. And that is the most common way that people are being infiltrated, that law firms are being infiltrated right now.
And that's interesting because we're tested, and I get that, but it's an interesting thing that you threw in there, the guilt factor, because we're all so polite. So by saying, oh, I tried to reach you and I couldn't. So now just out of politeness, we're like, oh, let me respond right away since I missed the other contact.
And I would also say another part is just being busy and not paying attention to what you're doing. I have failed a phishing attempt here at the bar because I know, and I felt so awful about it, but I was busy. My head was somewhere else. HR needed me to do this. I clicked the link and it was like, oh, you got caught with a phishing test. And it really made me be able to slow down and really focus on what the email is saying, who it's from, what they need, and if it's an actual phishing attempt or not.
That leads into my next question, because I'm laughing too, because it's almost become gamification here at the bar. We're a big organization. So you get a little scorecard if you've like, it'll say, oh, you found 4 of the 5 we sent. And I'm like, oh, what was the 5th one? How did I not report the 5th one? So that's been going on for a while. But my next question is, it used to be that if you were a small even a mid-sized firm, it was cost prohibitive to do these kind of like where they do intrusion tests, or they, you know, they spot check your staff, those kind of things. Let's talk about first steps and then what is most feasible for a small firm to do to protect themselves. What are the most cost-effective security controls that a small firm can implement?
So the very first thing that I mentioned to clients is your MFA. So your multi-factor authentication. And a perfect example of this is in an email, you want to have practice management software and in your banking software is the single highest impact control for a solo law firm. That means when you open up your email, your employee email, you put in your email password, that password prompting will trigger through another medium, a different type of password, if you will. So when I open up my work email, I receive, before I'm entered into the system or allowed access into the system, that is triggered to my personal cell phone or my business cell phone. And then I put in the code that is shown on the phone into my computer. And that lets my computer and lets our network know she has passed the multi-factor authentication. So it's two different mediums or sometimes three. You may sometimes have to get a phone call where you can authenticate through your voice. There are lots of different ways, but it has to be multiple levels. And that is the easiest way to protect your firm as an individual as you're communicating and doing your work on a day-to-day. Password managers. So instead of reusing and having simple passwords, password managers such as 1Password, for example, Bitwarden, Dashlane, they are affordable, low-cost alternative and options where it's prompting you every so often, maybe every 3 months or monthly, however, to change your password. This is another thing. There are tons of hackers that have software that they'll put into your system. So they've been unsuccessful. You've been hacked through a phishing attack, for example, and they're going to put a password manager reversal software onto your system. Ooh. So they're going to have that going. Yeah. They're going to have it going a million iterations until they find out what your password is. So it's very important that you don't just change one number, change the whole thing and change it as often as possible, because you don't have to follow that notification. You could do it every 2 months if you receive a quarterly notification, or you could do it every 6 weeks. It's really on you. You don't have to follow that. But these password managers are very helpful because they do remind you like, hey, this has been kind of latent for some time, and just have it in your mind that these reversal password managers, where they're basically trying to find out what your combination is by putting in an algorithm that's just doing as many iterations as it can, just infinitely, until it gets to your actual password. Another thing is, sure, go ahead.
Oh, I just want to call out some listeners, because I wonder if we walked into 100 law firms in Florida right now and we lifted up their keyboards, how many people have a post-it note with their passwords written out? Like, it's very secret underneath their passwords. And then are all of their usernames their very public email address? So like somebody who's in the building, you know, friend of a client or a vendor there. I'm always amazed that, and I've worked in a lot of law firms. And so attorneys that have little notebooks on their desk with their passwords and these post-its under the, you've got to get rid of that. Those days are, you know, you've got to do better. Or you use the same password for every single site you have.
It's so funny. When I went to law school is, you know, incredibly difficult on the mind. You're just inundated with tons of information. And so I can recall when my mind started kind of siphoning off information that it believed was not helpful for me to actually retain. So I was internalizing all of this law, but I would forget people's birthdays. And so I started using sticky notes to remember people's birthdays, because my mind literally just said, you know what? I don't have space for that. And so I think that's what a lot of attorneys are going through. You know, we're just kind of forced to learn so many things and be on call with that particular subset or that particular legal space. So a password, I'm like, ugh, I don't really need it. But that sticky note could put you out of a job. To be honest, you know, the wrong person taking that little sticky note and putting it somewhere out in the open, you know, could result in access that's unnecessary and probably violative of your business policies.
Or just take a quick picture with their phone and put it back so you think it's, yeah, you know, still safe because it's under the keyboard. So
exactly. Exactly.
Okay. So we've got MFA, password managers. Are there some other? So, and like these, a lot of those are free that you can be using. Okay.
They're free. And if they're not free and you're doing business, honestly, at scale, you'll probably have access to their basic tiers. So MFA is free. Password managers, these are free. You know, I think they scale up based off of how many people are in your business that would be using it. But, you know, that's a good thing. And this is something that, again, low cost and affordable, but absolutely should be in your bottom line if you're doing operations as a law firm.
What about, are there packages where a small firm could sign up and say, please send a few emails to my staff every once in a while to check them, give me some basic training? Are there real affordable things like that available now? So if they want to set up something more like try to hack my website, can you, you know, okay.
So there's filtering already built into Microsoft 365, Google Workspace, and then you have add-ons such as Proofpoint, Mimecast for firms that are wanting to do more. So this provides you with email security for like phishing, as you say. I believe that it's better for you to operationalize it, meaning take ownership of it and not just have these companies kind of doing it for you. But in your HR, in your incident response team, make sure that you're adding this as part of in your cybersecurity team, your IT team. Make sure that they're sending out those emails so that it's a collaborative effort, because that's another thing. The goal of a hacker is to infiltrate your entire company. So if you're just relying on one piece of software, one company to do it for you, there are other avenues that you can be attacked and you can be infiltrated. And so you have to have a situational awareness of how you do business. And I think that just having your own timeline and your own indicators in your calendar for when you should be doing these things is a way of taking ownership in that regard.
Perfect.
Candy, talk to us about mapping a firm's data. How does that process work and why is it important?
So data mapping, I think, is the strongest way for you in this day and age to stay in business. And the reason why I say it that candidly is because data is the most valuable resource that you have in your business. There's not a company, an organization that isn't utilizing someone else's data in order to profit. And so you have got to be aware of what data you have for two main reasons. The first reason why being aware of what data you have through the data mapping process, why it's so important, is that you have to make sure that you gain consumer trust. And so if you are communicating with someone and you're trying to gain their trust, you need to let them know that you know what to do with what they share with you. And so if you're in the financial services business and your firm is a financial services firm, you need to let them know that you are practicing in alignment with the law, and so that you are affording them the opportunity to entrust you with their financial data. Thankfully, we have laws in place that protect financial information. And so if your law firm is not aware that you even have that information, you are not going to be able to protect it, because there are specific rules and regulations that are in place that require you to conduct yourselves as a business with that data in mind. But we're multifaceted businesses. We're global businesses. And so you need to be aware of how you communicate and what you communicate with. So it's not just going to be financial data. It's going to be personal information. There's going to be incredible reputational risk associated with you just holding that data and protecting it. And so that's the first reason, is that consumer trust is one of the most valuable resources and ways to flex your muscle as a business nowadays. And data mapping and having a full understanding of what that data is critical. The second reason is that you want to stay in business. You want to make sure you want to make sure that you're able to grow as a business. And so as fast as technology is going, it's allowing us as law firms to provide a variety of resources and assistance to our consumers, to our clients. So we want to make sure that we're protecting their data so that they can maintain, we can maintain that trust, and that when we are audited, when we are questioned, when individuals, regulators are asking us how we're complying with the current laws, we want to be able to say, this is what we're doing. We have the data, we have comprehension of this, what this data, why we have this data, and we're operating in the way that our consumers, our clients, we told them we would. And that's why data mapping is so critical, because if you, the main FTC cases have to do with them. This is the critical reason why we have these cases. You have a policy in place, you have an operation, the way that you operate your business, and you have violated that because your consumer, your client, did not know that you were using their data in that way. They didn't know you were conducting business in the way that you are. Your policy is not in alignment with how you're actually doing business. And that is the biggest risk. Because honestly, when you look at it from a larger perspective, this is what slows down the economy. This is what keeps people's money in their pockets, as opposed to maintaining a flourishing society financially and data-wise. So that's why data mapping is so important.
It also brings up a separate topic, but related, file retention policies. I think back when everyone had warehouses and boxes of paper files, we all knew that about the file retention rules. So, you know, your trust account records, at least 6 years, if you're doing personal injury, those kind of things. I think once the Florida Bar allowed attorneys to digitally store all of that, a lot of them never deleted anything again. And we try to stress this to callers to the Practice Resource Center, where just like you would shred those old paper files, don't keep everything forever, because if you did get hacked, you've just like created the way larger liability for yourself. If you have every file for every client going back 25 years, you're going to have to deal with all of that, versus if you've been data mapping and you know, and you have a retention schedule, you know to go ahead and delete those things from your stored data. Are you seeing that issue too in your work?
Yes, that is, and I think it goes back to just the ethos of practice, of legal practice. You want to have as much information as possible. You want to be able to have like a timeline and have like the beginning and the middle of the end of this relationship, because you don't want to not remember a key point or a key factor. So I think that's just a natural ethos, but it is incredibly risky. You do have clients who want you to hold everything, but you should be pushing and utilizing their data as quickly as possible and then giving it back to them. And if you're not doing that, you need to make sure that that data is not on your live servers. Put it away, store it away. So I think about storage of data in three aspects: administratively, physically, and technologically. You want to make sure that you have retention policies in place for each aspect of it. So administratively, who has access to this data? That's a part of data mapping as well. Why do you have this data? What's the purpose of you having it? And then does everybody need to know about this one client, or is it just your white collar crime team, for example, your white collar defense team? So that's a part of data mapping as well. The physical aspect of it is, ideally, you don't want to have physical files anymore. You do want to operate in the cloud. It allows you to be able to do more. But you want to do the same thing as you said, shred it, essentially, get rid of it, remove it from your live servers if you even have to keep it in your storage. And then technologically, you want to protect that data. You want to make sure that you have systems in place that protect that data as it's in your possession. And so, yeah, I'm definitely still seeing it. But that comes with not having a sound governance program overall. And this is something that my company, my firm does. We outfit small to mid-sized firms, and we're beginning to go into much larger firms with data governance programs, and cybersecurity, information technology practices are absolutely a part of that.
Perfect. And we also want to stress that client notification is a huge deal. So there are clients that think if they come back 25 years from now, you're going to have their original will, or you have some closing statement. If you go to the document library on legalfield.com, we have all kinds of different fee agreements and retainer agreements. And we really stress have a retention and destruction policy. So up front, when that client signs with you, they've already been notified of how you're going to end the relationship with their data. That's really important. This feeds very nicely into my next question for you. When you read a story about some company that's been hacked, or they've gotten a ransom demand, they think they have everything backed up, and then it turns out that was access too. What is the correct way to do system backups so that they are clean and can be used to recover after a breach or ransom attack? So, like, let's talk about a really small firm. What should it look like? How are they backing up? Where is it going? If you can help us with that.
Okay. So backup strategies generally are going to be customized, right? Because depending on the data that you have, which is a part of you operationalizing your data mapping strategy, you have laws that are already in place that you have to comply with. And they have a lot of guidelines, and there's the best place for you to start with. But generally speaking, I like to go with, it's a rule, it's called the 3-2-1 rule. So you have three copies, physical copies of the data. And then you have two in a different media. So let's just say you have a physical piece of paper and it's sensitive information. You want to maybe have online notes relating to that or summarizing that physical piece of paper. Then you maybe want to have an audio documentation, audio recording, are explaining this data. And I'm talking about incredibly sensitive data, data that would disrupt your business if you did not have access to it. And then finally, you're going to have offsite or cloud representation as well. And this is tested periodically. So your cybersecurity team, your information technology team, it's going to go in periodically and check, do we still have access to this cloud services? Do we still have access to this cloud data backup of this particular information? So that happens. It's not just a set and forget. Once you develop your backup strategy, that's what's happening on a regular basis. So that's the rule that, 3-2-1 rule. I hope that helps. Three copies, two different pieces of media, and then one offsite or cloud as well.
Okay. What do you think of like, say, a solo or two attorneys, and they pay for secure cloud storage, but they do a physical server backup as well? Is that still a good solution for a small firm?
I believe it is. I mean, when I think about small, the only thing in my mind that differentiates what a small firm should be doing versus a large firm is costs. And so if the firm is able to do both, okay. But you just want to make sure that you're checking things. I do believe that you should have multiple media with having knowledge, access meaning knowledge of that data as a law firm. But it should be protected, because the more duplications of this, the more risky it becomes. And so if you're going to have these two different mediums in place, you want to make sure that your protections are doubly, enforced. And so that's where I'm headed. Like, the risk increases as more you retain more data, as it's being stored and in your possession, than if it was just a singular being on in the cloud.
I just feel like it's an overwhelming topic for people, because they think, well, I had two backups, but the ransom company got access to both and we didn't know it. So they were both, encrypted from us and we couldn't use them versus, and then like you said, there's the risk of if you have an on-site server, then say your building is robbed, it burns down, there's a hurricane and it's completely wiped out. I feel like you're like dodging all the different options of trying to keep your data.
So what I like to do when I first, like, we're deep diving with a new client is settling the nerves. So the first thing I like to let them know is that we are operating in a place of reasonableness. So risk is not 100% avoidable. But what you need to do is be aware, intimately and situationally aware of your business, how you do business, and operate from that. And so factors that I take into consideration, like we just discussed, such as cost, a small law firm might not necessarily need multiple avenues like that. They might not need different mediums. But if they had one that was incredibly protected, I think they would be better off. And so that's the conversation that needs to be had. I think generally it can be overwhelming if you're taking a look at the entire landscape. But if you focus on your business and how you want to do business, then you can hire someone like myself and who will consult with you and lead you down a solid governance program.
Great.
Can you tell us what an incident response plan is? Like, what is it? How can it help?
Sure. So incident response plans outfit organizations to protect themselves if a breach or a security incident occurs. And so just generally a security incident occurs when there's unauthorized access or use of the data that's in your possession. So your client's data, your business sensitive information has been accessed without your consent or authorization. This is what would trigger an incident response. So in order to walk it through as a simple sequence, you encounter a security incident, the first thing you want to do is you want to contain. So you want to, there's usually comes through, let's use the example of a phishing attack. So that might be one computer that has allowed access into your entire system by that one computer. So you want to contain it. You want to disconnect the affected devices and the other accounts immediately. You do not want to turn them off. You want to disconnect them. So you're going to communicate with your cybersecurity information security team and let them know that this has happened. And they're going to know what that means as far as disconnecting the affected device, right? Then you want to assess what's happened. So you want to find out what's been accessed, whose data has been accessed, how sensitive that data is. So you have client privilege information that raises the stakes significantly as opposed to it being business information. Then you want to, and this is something that I am beginning to bring up, and it is a new venture, is you want to talk to your cyber insurance carrier. You want to try to get cyber insurance coverage. A lot of companies now are not working with companies who do not have cybersecurity insurance. So you want to reach out to them. And you want to find out what the policy states and what's the approved, because sometimes these policies will explain, like, what's the approved breach coach, your forensics vendor, who are these external parties that's going to come in. I would also say, if you don't have cybersecurity insurance, call your local authorities and they will help you. Then you want to reach out to breach counsel, someone like myself in the state of Florida, I can serve as breach counsel, and so, or your forensics IT team. And that's often provided through your cyber policy, or you could retain a company, a firm like myself, and we would provide that type of service. And we're going to then figure out how we're going to communicate, what the internal external messaging would be, and then just work on compliance as far as a regulatory perspective.
You hit on several important things. So
sure.
I learned this at the technology symposium. So I think it's a real natural reaction that when you realize, uh-oh, I just clicked on something. So you get yourself off the network. The whole don't turn it off, I didn't realize it's because you don't want to turn it off because they need to be able to look at your computer to go through the, to see what happened and to see the intrusion. And I didn't realize that if you just shut it down, you're gonna lose that. So I was like, oh, excellent point. Because when you're panicking, you're just trying to like get yourself as far away from the intruder as you can. And I think a lot of times, let's talk about how people, you mentioned earlier that they can access your stuff and then just sit for a long time, which is super creepy. But I think a lot of times when an attorney realizes they've been breached, it's that moment where someone says, they call up and say, hey, I just got a really weird email from you. And they're like, you realize, oh no, someone has taken over. They got your password. Now they're acting like you. You've been shut out of your own email. So they're sending out, you know, all of these emails pretending to be you. What are some other ways that you know that you've been breached? What are the tells?
Good ways that you know. There might be like a weird movement on your computer. It's open and like your mouse might kind of jump a little bit. The hypothetical you just gave is perfect, where someone actually calls you and tells you like, hey, this was from you, but it didn't sound like you, or this is not how we normally do things as it relates to this. And so, yeah, I mean, they're becoming incredibly sophisticated. Is the unfortunate part is that I think the best way to protect yourself is to just keep participating in these testing, you know, getting caught on a phishing test, you know, is helpful in the sense that you now, this is a more nuanced way that this is being presented. But glitches on your computer, if all of a sudden you could be communicating with someone via telephone and now they're communicating with you via email, if there are lots of typos in the email, phishing is, I think, about 85% of the gateway for most of them. So you want to focus on taking a look at your emails, a lot of typos, glitches in your mouse, or just... sometimes there could be an update, right? An update on your computer. And let's say you work on a team. Ask your other members of your team if they also had that update. So that's something that I discuss with my teammates because we are constantly updating our software, right? So maybe once a week, if that's just the cadence, I want to know what's happening with your computer because IT might not be sending a notification to everyone that this is going to happen. But you want to kind of bring that up like, oh, my computer updated to yours. If you had access, now I'm kind of on a roll, Christine. So if you had access, if you had access to, let's just say Adobe, for an example, if you had access to Adobe last week, you were using Adobe for perfectly fine. And then all of a sudden you have to put in your email address and password to access it. And that was not the usual way. That could be something.
Well, so, and I'm laughing because I've had attorneys say proudly, that's why I never do any updates. And I'm like, no, no. You don't have all the security patches from. So, okay. So I just want to stress the ones that, you know, the legit ones, please be doing those to keep your system up to date. So
Absolutely.
And then you, I'm so glad you brought up cyber insurance because I think when I started at the bar 11 years ago, nobody had ever heard of that. And I think people were like, oh, that's so expensive and I'll never need that. And you mentioned this. Now having cyber insurance can actually reduce the premium for your professional liability insurance. And so it goes hand in hand. So if you're like, if you have dismissed getting cyber insurance, please take another look at that. Typically, if you're going with a you know, big mid to mid-size carrier that's doing your professional liability, a lot of times they can actually write that policy and add it on. There's Florida Bar member benefits. There's some listed in there. So I do want to stress it's way more affordable and accessible than it used to be.
Yes, it absolutely is. That's a great point. I wrote a book called AI in Business, Legal, Ethical, and Innovative Insights. And one of the future-proofing chapters focused primarily on cyber insurance. I have negotiated cyber insurance with insurers in order, you know, for small to mid-sized firms, just trying to find a way to get that line item in without, you know, getting rid of their bottom line. But it's a new line item worth prioritizing. And as far as framing it, you want to frame it as a resource to your financial decision makers at your firm, not just a cost, since it often comes with the breach response support built into it. So when you're communicating and advocating for this, having listened to this and attended the technology symposium, you shouldn't just bring it up as this is just a part of the budget. Really talk about the inability to maintain business and to grow business if a breach should occur, because you have to find the money from somewhere. But if you have that cybersecurity insurance in place, not only will you be able to gain vendor trust and consumer trust, because that's an additional protective measure, but you'll have this resource should something occur.
And maybe you'll even sleep better at night, like you mentioned before, like settling their nerves. So.
Yes, it helps. It's a great way to settle your nerves. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to switch gears real quick, and we're going to talk briefly about the Florida Information Protection Act. So this is the state's data breach notification law. It requires businesses to protect confidential personal information and notify individuals and the state within 30 days of a qualifying breach. So how does a firm know who must be notified, and what if the breach is a lost laptop that was encrypted?
Okay, so that law took effect in July 2014, and it's been kind of expanded upon over time. So businesses, according to that law, businesses must notify affected individuals within 30 days of determining a breach occurred, and you have a 15-day grace period of good cause. So this is one of the strictest fixed deadlines in the country. Notification is required if a breach affects more than 500 people statewide within 30 days of discovery. And so what I want to focus on here is that when we discover that a breach has occurred, so there is a fine line between a security incident and an actual breach. And sometimes it can take a considerable amount of time to find out if an actual breach occurred and who you need to notify. And so in that regard, I think you can lean on that when you're figuring out when you should actually notify. The question about a laptop, it depends. It really does depend on context. When you're going to be communicating with regulators, or if that has been triggered, it's all about context. So what's on that laptop? Whose laptop is it? Are we sure that this laptop is what allowed the data to be actually infiltrated? So you want to go through your entire investigation before you land on notification to regulators. As far as consumers, as far as your clients, I am of the belief that you can disclose what you know. So if you are still in the process of investigating, notify your consumers, notify your clients that you are still in the business of investigating. The problem arises when you do not disclose. Months go by, a regulator comes in, and then they are requiring you to notify, and you still don't know the impact. Because from the outside looking in, you do not look like you value that data. And again, it goes back to consumer trust. You don't look like you cared enough to tell me that something went wrong. There's no telling what what may happen in the end. But it's that failure, the lack of communication with your client that I believe causes more harm than good, especially if a regulator has to tell you to follow the laws that you said you would by operating as a law firm.
And that's interesting. It goes back to a lot of client notification is if you're shutting down, it says current client. So that's up to the attorney to decide who's a current client. In this situation, if you had data mapped and you had concluded this matter with a client and the time it had elapsed for you to retain their file and you deleted it, obviously that's one less person you have to notify because you know their stuff wasn't compromised. Is that accurate?
So when you said current client, the reason why I didn't focus on that is because because in reality, a lot of law firms have data that they shouldn't have. And so right. There was recently there was I don't want to blurry the facts, but there was a business that had information. It was an auto insurance or automobile company. They had data from years ago for someone who had a lease. And that data was then found in the dark web, and that individual suffered great financial harm. And so they sued that automobile company because they just had that data. So in the context of a current relationship, if I am the client and you have my data in your server, you are effectively responsible to treat that data as if I was still your client. Because if I wasn't your client, then you should have some data retention policy in place where that data wouldn't be on your live servers. That's the argument that I'm going to make. And that's probably going to be successful because the basis of all consumer protection law and data privacy law is to protect consumers, protect people, keep people interested in doing business. And if you're not protecting my data because you don't have any policies or retention policies in place, then that's on you. So I wouldn't focus on the fact that it's current. If it's clear that you're current, but if your actions make it seem like we're still in this relationship because I'm in your life, my data is in your life servers. Hey, maybe I don't constitute. Maybe this isn't I'm not a past client at all.
Right.
Can you talk to us about the issue of data access? Because the typical default seems to be that all employees can access everything. Why is this such a big problem?
I think, the first thing that came to mind just now was businesses scaling up. So at first, you know, you're wearing lots of hats and, you know, your HR is your legal and your legal is your IT. You know, you're hiring with people with of the ability to do lots of things. And that helps you scale businesses. It helps you start small and grow, right? I think that there's also value. It's like a pro to being very interested in how your company works. And so you want to gain a skill set that you didn't necessarily have when you entered into the company. So you're doing more than one thing. There's also an efficiency aspect. It might be helpful to be able to have multiple individuals who can answer a question or get into your repositories. Fine. The problem is that we are operating at such a fast pace right now that sometimes your answers aren't as robust or as full or as complete because there isn't just one individual who's handling that skill set, that subset. And so I do think we need to kind of get back to that because networks are, you know, there's tons of tentacles and there should be like siphoning off. And this is how you allocate risk. You kind of compartmentalize risk within your workflow by making sure that, okay, this person has this first aspect of it. And if need be, we escalate. And then that's how you get that data because of technology. These tentacles are so easily accessed. And then also, if I'm able to do the task, but I don't understand the reason why that task is in place, I may unnecessarily divulge more information than I need to. And that's what you lose when you have individuals working with multiple hats. The reason why that person has that skill set through and through, you might not necessarily know, but you know how to do the function. And so I think that's why there's pros and cons to having multifaceted data access, but the GAAP principles clearly talk about making sure that it's a need to know basis. That's how data should be siphoned off. Escalation paths are key. If I need to divulge that information to someone else in order to get the answer to complete the task, then I would. But I'm going to be as minimized as possible with my communication so that we're not divulging more than we need to in order to get rid of that task.
That makes sense. And I bring this back to a very small firm because you talked about like the growth of the business. So you started out and you had one staff support who was your receptionist and your paralegal. Then you hired three more people and they're mm-hmm. all set to the same access of maybe your practice management software. So many people that are using software don't realize that there are built-in toggles where you can change the role of a user and you're not paying anything extra for this because the person who's managing your trust account, you know, the receptionist doesn't need to see how much is in the client trust accounts. The receptionist probably just needs contact information, your calendar, those kind of things. So if you talk to whatever software you're using to manage your firm, if you talk to your provider, they can just very quickly show you those roles and how to set that to just, so if the receptionist is the one who clicked on the phishing attempt, getting that person's credentials is not going to be, it's not the key to the kingdom to open every part of your firm. So we stress that those roles need to be set to safeguard.
Yeah, absolutely. And not just internally, but externally. You know, you have vendor communication. There's so much that we're doing through vendors now. We need to make sure that our contracts have this language in place that we're auditing, and it's not this full-blown audit, but you could compartmentalize what that audit means. Once a quarter, we're able to audit your information security policies. But maybe once a year, we're able to audit on a larger scale because you want to make sure that this risk allocation is compartmentalized through the workflow. And if a vendor has access to your data and is a key part of your workflow, you want to be able to have control over that. Well, not control, but awareness of that.
That's a good point. It leads right into rule 4-1.1, talks about the competent representation may involve the retention of a non-lawyer advisor who does have that technological competence, someone like yourself. And then 4-5.3 says, but you're still responsible for the supervision of your non-lawyer staff and all these vendors. So you still need to hire a professional for this, but can you just talk about the benefits and risks of the vendor? How are you vetting someone to make sure that it's okay to let them in and help you? How do you check that?
So one of the main things that we do is we do research. If a vendor is, find out how critical this vendor is. What is the reason why this vendor is going to be entering into your workflow? And what data are they going to be accessing and for what purpose? So again, the rules change if it's client data versus if it's your business data. So depending on what data they actually will have access to, you're going to implement, I would advise, more stringent or protective measures around that relationship. And that relationship is going to be reflected in their information security practices. So the actual vendor, what does their security practices look like? What certifications do they have from an information technology perspective? How frequently do they audit their own systems? And then how seamlessly their systems integrate with our systems. So these are the main things that I'm going to take a look at. That's going to be visible in our contract language. I'm going to have specific detailed language in our contract governing that relationship. There's going to be discussions about cybersecurity insurance. And then I'm going to be able to come on site or get access to them on a regular basis as far as auditing that what is in the contract is in compliance with what they're actually doing. So that's what's most important, is just making sure that we are aware that what they said to us in a B2B pitching relationship is articulated in our contracts, and it's actually how they do business.
That makes sense.
Let's circle back to the staff within the firm. How can firms train their staff and then ensure that their security policies are being followed long after the training has ended?
So that's a great question. I am very much interested in seeing more collaborative, community positive orientation to technology. That's a lot of reason why I started my company and why I started my podcast. I think that there's this huge disconnect because we're focused on technology and focused with big industries like the legal industry, the financial services industry, that everyday people feel disconnected from this stuff, but we're the most impacted because it's our data that's actually integrated throughout this entire system. And so your day-to-day, everyday person should be excited about protecting their company. They should be honored to be interacting with their clients' data. This is what helps them do business. This is what a part of their livelihood. That's like the general idea that should be brought around your company. You want to train in the way that they need to. You want to focus on use cases. So your HR team is probably going to want to see more like policies or just written documentation, because that's how they operate. Whereas your sales team might want to see more financial metrics, how it's going to boost the bottom line, things like that. So you want to focus on use cases that work with that specific audience. I call them roadshows. Once an organization has a cogent policy, we then go into different department units and explain to them how this affects their, how they do their job. And so you want to train it that way. Gamify it if you can. Our team, we actually have like going bet, if you will. Oh, did you get caught on the phishing this month? You know, so we do it all the time. And so that makes it fun. And that keeps you aware without that nervousness. You're actually like excited, like, okay, I didn't get caught, or there's a phishing email. I got one, you know, get ready, pay attention. And then you want to do it at least annually, taking a look at how your business is running from a governance perspective. So you, again, want to take a look at your data mapping. Again, the goal is to grow your business. So you might be using one piece of data to do your business. So then you want to grow and you have a whole different department that's going to utilize a different type of data. Or there's new legislation that has come out that now you have to comply in a different way. And the only way to do that is if you have everyone involved in making sure that your company is protected. I think that's the best way to grow your business, especially now.
I agree. I was thinking about the gamification aspect of that. It, you know, you could do a leaderboard if you get some little prize for you caught all five phishing attempts. I think people get excited about that. I think the other thing that's important too is that your staff knows what to do after they click that link, because you don't want staff members who are, they just don't mention it because they're horrified that it was them, that, you know, that they know who to contact and that it's, there's a procedure in place if they've accidentally clicked the link that they should not have.
Yeah, your policy should definitely note that there won't be any retaliation. Have an email address. It doesn't have to be this big, huge process, but maybe an email address that you could reach out to if you think you've done something wrong, which would then get sent to maybe your incident response team or your privacy policy team, and then they can work through that with them. But definitely in your policies, make sure that you're mentioning that there won't be retaliation for attempting to comply with your policies.
Nice. Candy, this has been very helpful. If our listeners have questions or they want to learn more, where can they find you and some of your resources?
Sure. So I can be reached at techmeout.consulting. That's my website. There's a search engine where you can type in your information. We provide consulting services around a variety of governance programs, data privacy, cybersecurity, and AI governance. Also, I have a Substack called The Human Voice of AI, where I just discuss cybersecurity, artificial intelligence, and data governance issues that arise. I'm also active on LinkedIn. I have an infographic series called AI And, where I just have concentric circles talking about the impact of artificial intelligence with any given topic. I think this, we just closed out AI and Health, which was a four-part series. And next month, I think, is going to be artificial intelligence in war. So, and I can be reached via email at connect@techmeout.consulting.
Perfect. And we'll link to all of these resources that we've mentioned today. So if you are listening on a podcast app or out on YouTube, you can go to legalfuel.com and go to our podcast and you'll see all the links to these resources. Well, it looks like we've reached the end of our program. Thank you so much, Key and Dave, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you like what you heard today, please rate us on Apple Podcasts and join us next time for another episode of the Florida Bar's Legal Fuel Podcast, brought to you by the Practice Resource Center of the Florida Bar. I'm Christine Bilbrey.
And I'm Autumn Chadwell. Until next time, thank you for listening.
If you'd like more information about today's show, please visit legalfuel.com. Don't miss an episode by subscribing to the Florida Bar's podcast via iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and RSS. Find the Florida Bar's Practice Resource Center, Legal Fuel, on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, the Florida Bar. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.
Are you looking to grow your practice? Consider joining the Florida Bar's Lawyer Referral Service. There's never been a better time to apply because we are currently waiving the $125 annual fee, so members who qualify can join the Florida Bar LRS for free. All panel members of the Florida Bar Lawyer Referral Service must be licensed in Florida, must be members in good standing, and must carry a minimum of $100,000 in professional liability insurance to participate. Panel members must also maintain an office physically located in one of the 52 Florida counties served by the Florida Bar Lawyer Referral Service. For more information and to apply, please go to floridabar.org/LRS.